Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments you can hear Joan Knows. Joan Lewis, EWTN's bureau chief here in Rome, brings us the Vatican Week in review. But first we join Jill Bevilacqua, who presents this week's edition of There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye.
Jesus went out to the Mount of Olives. At daybreak, he reappeared in the temple area, and when the people started coming to him, he sat down and began to teach them. The scribes and the Pharisees led a woman forward who had been caught in adultery. They made her stand there in front of everyone. "Teacher," they said to him, "this woman has been caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses ordered such women to be stoned. What do you have to say about the case?" They were posing this question to trap him so that they could have something to accuse him of. Jesus simply bent down and started tracing on the ground with his finger. When they persisted in their questioning, he straightened up and said to them, "Let the man among you who has no sin be the first to cast a stone at her." A second time he bent down and wrote on the ground. Then the audience drifted away one by one, beginning with the elders. This left him alone with the woman, who continued to stand there before him. Jesus finally straightened up again and said to her, "Woman, where did they all disappear to? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she answered. Jesus said, "Nor do I condemn you. You may go, but from now on, avoid this sin."
If you're driving a car with a non-driver sitting next to you, it's almost certain that when you ask for a direction, your passenger will give it to you the exact moment you have to turn right or left, causing the driver behind to brake suddenly when he sees your indicator light. It's always a help to know a little in advance where exactly you're going next. Our Sunday Gospels often have something of the abruptness of those directions. On occasions they begin, "at that time." On others, we're plunged right into the action, like today. Jesus went out to the Mount of Olives. Went out from where? Unlike our driver, we know where he goes next, because we're told, at daybreak, he reappeared in the temple area. Ah, so he had been in the temple area. Teaching and healing, presumably. But let's look at our New Testament. In the Jerusalem Bible, chapter 8 of John's Gospel begins, "And Jesus went to the Mount of Olives." But the previous chapter ends, "They all went home." Who were they? And what had been going on exactly? Let's set the scene. It's autumn, and in Jerusalem the Feast of Tabernacles is in full swing. Feast of Tents or Booths, Sukkot, from the Hebrew word for thickets or huts. But its original name was the Feast of Ingathering, and was the climax of the agricultural year, celebrating the final gathering in of the harvest and the vintage. It's mentioned in the two most ancient calendars, we're told, as we read in Exodus. "You must celebrate the Feast of Ingathering at the end of the year, when you gather in the fruits of your labours from the fields." The New Jerome Bible Handbook tells us,
"Of the three annual pilgrimage feasts, this was the most important and the best attended. Like the feasts of unleavened bread and of weeks, the Feast of Tents was an agricultural feast. It marked the ingathering of all the produce of the fields, the products of the threshing floors, and of the wine and oil presses. When the earth had yielded all its bounty for the current year, and that bounty had been gathered and stored, the people gave joyful thanks to God." The analogy with Thanksgiving Day is obvious. There was dancing, singing, and general merriment, including, apparently, a generous sampling of the new wine. The ritual of the feast is described as a pilgrimage to the temple, and it lasted 7 days. From Numbers we learn what sacrifices were offered. In Leviticus, that for 7 days the people are to live in huts, in memory of how the Israelites lived after their liberation from Egypt, and to gather foliage from majestic trees, branches of palms, and boughs of myrtles and of valley poplars, and make merry before the Lord. Later historical texts make it clear that the foliage was carried in procession, as in the Palm Sunday ceremony. The feast began as a harvest festival, as its earliest name, Ingathering, suggests, and as the ancient texts indicate. Even after it had taken on a name inspired by an accidental part of the ritual, huts, tents, tabernacles or booths, it remained essentially an agricultural feast.
Until the advent of modern farm machinery, the bringing in of the last load of the corn of the harvest was always celebrated in England by the harvesters singing the Harvest Home song. For on that occasion, the farmer provided a supper known as a Harvest Home, which was followed by a general jollification. In the north of England, the celebration was called a Mel supper, from the French mêlé, to mingle together. For on these occasions, wrote one chronicler in 1801, the servant and his master are alike, and everything is done with equal freedom. They sit at the same table, converse freely together, and spend the remaining part of the night in dancing and singing, without any difference or distinction. While the Jewish feasts of Passover and Pentecost have their Christian equivalents in our Easter and Pentecost, no similar feast of ingathering appeared until the year 1843, when the Reverend R.S. Hawker, vicar of Morwenstow in Cornwall, set aside Sunday, October the 1st, as a day to thank God for the harvest. The idea caught on, and the practice spread throughout the Church of England and is still popular today. Churches are decorated with corn, fruit, vegetables, and produce of all kinds, especially in country parishes. In 1844, Henry Alford wrote in his Harvest Hymn,
"Come, ye thankful people, come, raise the song of Harvest Home. All is safely gathered in, ere the winter storms begin."
And Eleanor Fargen, children's writer of the earlier 20th century, pictured the church scene.
"Turn the churches into bowers, little birds shall sing in, where the children sing their glee. God the Lord will bless the throng, lifting up its autumn song, gladly in thanksgiving."
And before we come to the serious matter of our gospel, let's listen to these lines from John Betjeman's Diary of a Church Mouse, in which the poet gives his own humorous impression of the festival, seen mainly from the mouse's point of view.
"For me, the only feast of all is autumn's harvest festival, when I can satisfy my want with ears of corn around the font. I climb the eagle's brazen head to burrow through a loaf of bread. I scramble up the pulpit stair and gnaw the marrows hanging there. It is enjoyable to taste these items ere they go to waste, but how annoying when one finds that other mice with pagan minds come into church my food to share, who have no proper business there. A large and most unfriendly rat comes in to see what we are at. This year he stole a sheaf of wheat. It screened our special preacher's seat. And prosperous mice from fields away come in to hear the organ play, and under cover of its notes ate through the altar's sheaf of oats. While I, who starve the whole year through, must share my food with rodents who, except at this time of the year, not once inside the church appear. Within the human world, I know such goings-on could not be so. For human beings only do what their religion tells them to. But all the same, it's strange to me how very full the church can be with people I don't see at all, except at harvest festival."
That year of 29 AD, Jesus did not go up to Jerusalem at the beginning of the Feast of Tabernacles. His brothers, cousins or other relations, urged him to go down into Judea. "Let your disciples see the works you are doing," they said. And as one writer put it, if he was ever to have a sensational success in Jerusalem, the Feast of Tabernacles provided the ideal setting. Frank Sheed tells us something of the spectacular quality of this feast.
On the first evening, golden lampstands were set up in the court of the women, a space open to everybody. These stands were enormous, 150 feet high, we are told, and as the lamps were lit, there was singing of canticles and playing of musical instruments. The sound of the music could be heard 20 miles away in Jericho. We read of a torch dance, with the highest dignitaries of Israel dancing to a set rhythm with lighted torches thrown high into the air and caught again. In every mind was the pillar of fire which had given light to the Israelites in the desert.
Although the feast had its religious significance, it was also clearly the opportunity for a great big party. On the eighth day, we read, the huts were abandoned and the whole day given to carnival. This was not what Jesus had come for. So he told his relatives, go up to the festival yourselves. I'm not going, because for me the time is not ripe yet. And so he stays behind in Galilee. But, we read, after his brothers had left for the festival, he went up as well, but quite privately, without drawing attention to himself. And it's not until the feast is nearly over that he goes up into the temple and teaches, declaring that he has come from God and that his teaching is God's. The guards are sent to arrest him, but they return to the priests and Pharisees empty-handed. Never did man speak like this man, is their only explanation. So you've been led astray as well, jeer the Pharisees. Have any of the authorities believed in him? No, only the mob, and they know nothing about the law. And does the law judge a man before he has had a hearing? Asks Nicodemus, who is also a Pharisee, but who has met and spoken with Jesus by night. Are you a Galilean too? He is taunted. Go into the matter, and you'll see. Prophets do not come out of Galilee. The Messiah, they knew, must be born in Bethlehem, the city of David. But Jesus is never quoted as mentioning his birthplace. And it's at this point that the party breaks up. They all went home, and Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. Night has fallen. But next morning, he's back again in the temple area. At daybreak, we heard. Other versions have simply early in the morning. Perhaps he's still coming down the hill as the city ramparts light up with the first rays of the sun, which rises over Jerusalem from behind the Mount of Olives. This is slightly higher than the city, 826 metres, we're told. As he descends, he sees in front of him the towering white and gold mass of the temple. A priest comes out on a pinnacle, as he does every morning, to look towards the east and report, "The sun is shining already." And the assembled priests cry out, "Is the sky lit up as far as Hebron?" And the watcher responds, "It is lit up as far as Hebron." And shortly afterwards, there's a shrilling of silver trumpets to announce that the first sacrifice of the day has been offered on the altar of burnt offerings. The smell of incense fills the air. The temple courtyards are still in shadow, but there are people about, despite the early hour. The pilgrims who have come up for the feast spend as much time as they can at the temple. And this particular feast was attended by women also. Men were required by the law to appear before the Lord 3 times a year. The women apparently went with them on some occasions, but were not obliged to. In a Bible handbook, we read,
as head of the family, the husband or father presented the sacrifice and offerings on behalf of the entire family. But the wife might also be present. Women attended the Feast of Tabernacles, the yearly feast of the Lord, and the festival of the new moon. By New Testament times, the Jewish women had stopped being active in temple or synagogue worship.
And significantly for our gospel episode today is this next sentence.
Although there was a special area at the temple known as the Court of the Women, women were not allowed to go into the inner court.
And it is in the Court of the Women that we find Jesus, sitting on a low bench or stool, probably, teaching the crowds that are already thronged to him. Then there's a sudden hush and drawing back as a woman is pushed in amongst the crowd by a group of scribes and Pharisees. She has been caught in adultery. The spies had certainly been out that night. How many other infidelities had been committed during this time of feasting? We're only told of one. Writes our handbook,
the Hebrews considered adultery a serious threat to the family, so they punished adulterers swiftly and harshly. A man and a woman caught in the act of adultery must both die by stoning.
And after quoting Deuteronomy, our scholar adds this in brackets.
It's interesting to note here that when the Pharisees dragged an adulteress to Jesus and wanted to stone her, they had already broken the law themselves by letting the man get away.
An interesting note indeed. And then the Pharisees ask Jesus what he has to say about this case of adultery. But he says nothing, just bends down and writes with his finger on the ground. A recognised way, we're told, of indicating that one wished to take no part in the conversation, an invitation to the others to go away. But they don't go away, and insist with their question. Then Jesus utters those celebrated words which have passed into language and become proverbial. Let him that is without sin cast the first stone. Again he bends down and writes again on the ground. This action has apparently been seen by some scholars as an allusion to some words of Jeremiah referring to the temple and the Lord.
All who abandon you will be put to shame. All who turn from you will be uprooted from the land, written in the dust.
Although the episode of the woman taken in adultery is accepted as authentic by the scholars, it's uncertain which of the evangelists actually wrote it. A note in the Jerusalem Bible reads,
"The author of this passage is not John. The oldest manuscripts do not include it or place it elsewhere. The style is that of the synoptics."
And in fact, another scholar notes that some codices put it in Luke's Gospel. Whoever reported the incident, however, its teaching is crystal clear. Jesus did not deny the law, nor the fault. But instead of looking at the situation from a legal viewpoint, he shifted the emphasis to a moral one. "And the moral sense of the Jews," writes Bargellini, "even that of the scribes and Pharisees, was such that they could not but apprehend the profound truth of those words. And so, one by one, they melted away. Where are they? Has no one condemned you? No one, sir. Neither do I condemn you. Go away and don't sin any more." And Bargellini concludes,
"Only he, the innocent one, could have condemned her, and only one who had the power to condemn her could also pardon her, making mercy triumph over justice, which is the perfect justice of God."
Well, thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua. She'll be back again at this same time next week with the next edition of There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. In the meantime, let's join Joan Lewis, EWTN's bureau chief here in Rome, who brings us a bird's eye view of the past week in the Vatican. Joan, welcome back. It's been a quiet week, as we know. The Pope's been away.
Yeah.
For a very special reason.
He's been on retreat, something I think we'd all love to do and just never have the time to do. He and many members of the Roman Curia have been on retreat. They went to Ariccia, south of Rome, on Sunday afternoon and are due back almost as we speak. If we look out the window, maybe we can see their minibuses bringing them back to the Vatican and the Santa Marta. But I want to look in a moment at the history of retreats, because it is kind of interesting how they began and who started them. But retreats have been in many, many places throughout history, but specifically in the Vatican, they have an interesting story. But let's kind of look at the last one of the last public things of the week, really, that the Pope did, and of course that was the typical Sunday Angelus. That was filled with so much news on Sunday. Always at the Angelus, before the prayer, the Pope reflects on the Gospel of the day, which was about the prodigal son last Sunday. And then after the Angelus, he might refer to world events, point something out. And in this case, the Pope spoke, and not for the first time, about the four nuns who were killed in Yemen, the sisters of the Missionaries of Charity. And in the Angelus, the Pope called them modern day. Of course, they were serving in a home for the elderly. The nuns were killed, but they were four of 16 people who died. And the Pope noted that they gave their blood for the church, and they're not only victims of the attackers, but also, this is interesting, of this indifference of globalization He had learned about the attack, of course, on Friday, said he was shocked and profoundly saddened, obviously, when he learned about it. And a message was sent through Cardinal Parolin, and the Pope assured people of his prayers and spiritual closeness to everybody. And he called it this act of senseless and diabolical violence. In the message, the Pope prayed that this pointless slaughter will awaken consciences, lead to a change of heart, and inspire all parties to lay down their arms and take up the path of dialogue. And I think the most awful thing about the entire event was when it became known that what the gunmen did, they entered the building, they entered this home for the elderly, they went room to room, they handcuffed the people, and then, of course, they shot them. On a slightly more positive side, at the Angelus on Sunday, the Pope did praise an ecumenical project, this is interesting, to fly refugees to Europe, quote, as a concrete sign of commitment for peace and life. And this is a pilot project. He described it as a reality that unites solidarity with security, allowing the safe transfer of people who are fleeing war and violence, such as the 100 refugees who have already arrived in Italy, among whom there are minors, sick people, disabled people, war widows, and elderly. They're always the ones that suffer the most, aren't they? These categories that the Pope named. And in particular, Pope Francis said he was very happy. He praised the initiative as an ecumenical one because there's the support of the Sant'Egidio community here in Rome, Federation of Italian Evangelical Churches, the Waldesian and the Methodist churches. And so after all these messages, the Pope closed by asking for prayers for the retreat. And now maybe we can just kind of, you know, look back at the retreat. If this wasn't radio, you'd be seeing a link to a site that shows the beautiful place where everybody is staying in Arica. And it's so interesting because this town, it's like 20, 25 miles south of Rome. It's in what are called the Castelli Romani, the Roman hill.
So the hills.
The Roman hill towns, exactly, and where Castel Gandolfo is. And it's so interesting that Pope Francis likes to spend these 6 days out there on retreat instead of in the Vatican because he doesn't go to Castel Gandolfo. He has said openly in interviews and everything, I'm really not a person who knows how to take a vacation. You know, for him, a vacation is working. So the papal palace there goes unused. But in any event, everyone was brought out to Arica on Sunday afternoon, and the retreat really begins then at about 6 p.m. They have Eucharistic adoration, Vespers, and then dinner. And then the following days are all the same schedule time-wise, meditations, Mass, Vespers, and meals. And it's interesting, the retreat master is a priest from the Servants of Mary, Father Hermes Ronchi, and he preached on 10 questions from the Gospel. And, of course, all of our listeners are going to be able to place these. They will have heard them. Who are you looking for? Why are you afraid? Do you have no faith? And when Christ says, you're the salt of the earth, but if the salt becomes tasteless, how can it be made salty again? Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking? Of course, the resurrection. Simon, son of John, do you love me? Etc. And Mary's question to the angel, how can this be at the Annunciation? So would have been amazing reflections on these topics. But to look at the history of the retreats, now normally they take place, they begin the Sunday after Ash Wednesday, but of course this year Pope Francis was in Mexico, so they just chose a later date. So it began on Sunday, March 6th. Actually, at the very beginning, it was Pius XI who set up retreats. In the beginning, they did take place the first week of Advent. That was moved at some point to the first full week of Lent. Now, Pius XI, in 1929, December 20th of 1929, he was celebrating the 50th anniversary of his priestly ordination, and he wrote the encyclical Mens Nostra on the promotion of spiritual exercises. And it was at that time that he informed the faithful, you know, that he had this brilliant idea of holding spiritual exercises every year in the Roman Curia. And since that date, we have had these exercises. Although there have been retreats for centuries, we think of them within a religious order, but something established specifically in Vatican City. And actually, this is 1929. This is the same year that Vatican City State became an independent city-state. In the encyclical, the Pope mentioned he looked at the many and rich fruits of jubilees expressing, and he said, as a way to express our heartfelt gratitude, we, and this was when the popes used the pontifical we instead of I. He said, we have deemed it fitting to establish something most excellent, which will, we trust, prove a source of many advantages to the Christian people. We are speaking of the practice of spiritual exercises. And he said, we want this to see it daily extended more widely, not just among the clergy, but also among the multitudes of the Catholic laity. And it was very interesting because in the history of retreats, Pius XI quoted his predecessors. He quoted doctors of the church. He quoted founders of religious orders. And in particular, he quoted St. Ignatius of Loyola. And if our listeners have ever heard of an Ignatian retreat, you're talking about a 30-day retreat. In any event, of course, St. Ignatius, founder of the Jesuits, the Pope said, whom we are pleased to call the chief and peculiar master of spiritual exercises. In fact, on July 22, 1922, Pope Pius had, quote, declared and constituted St. Ignatius of Loyola the heavenly patron of all spiritual exercises, and therefore of institutes, sodalities, and bodies of every kind, assisting those who are making the spiritual exercises. More than anything else, Pius XI underscored the joy and consolation he found in spiritual exercises and retreats. So,
there was some news this week, though, Joan.
Oh, yeah, actually, pretty big news. We probably could have started, but we will certainly focus on it right now. And that is that on Tuesday, March 15th, Pope Francis will hold an ordinary public consistory of cardinals in the Vatican, during which he will sign the decree for the canonization of Blessed Mother Teresa of Kolkata, known to many as Calcutta, and four others. And then what is expected that day are the dates and venue of the ceremonies. They are expected to be declared then. And, of course, it was only last December 17th, 2015, that the Pope cleared the way for Mother Teresa for sainthood by recognizing a miraculous healing through her intercession of a Brazilian man with multiple brain abscesses. And, of course, she was, oh, my gosh, I think you must have been here for this. She was beatified, given the title blessed, in October 19th, 2003. And I can remember people began filling St. Peter's Square, coming to St. Peter's Square, lining Via della Conciliazione at 3 in the morning. Because, like, places like the Hotel Columbus, people couldn't even sleep because they could hear all these people kind of talking and singing. And if I remember correctly, the Swiss guards had open security. I mean, the security people had open security at something like 6:30 instead of the typical 8 o'clock for this mass because the crowds were so enormous. I think I was in my seat at 7:45 or something like that. So now the date bandied about, and I have had a very direct confirmation, the date that has been mentioned and will be on the Jubilee year calendar is September 4th of this year, of 2016. So,
but it's not official yet.
It hasn't been announced, but you can take my word on this. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Joan. We're listening there to Joan Lewis, EWTN's bureau chief here in Rome. That brings me up to time. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. This is Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.